Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Is to announce $14 billion in U.S. business with Africa, and British Airways suspends flights to Liberia and Sierra Leone. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. President Barack Obama will announce that U.S. businesses have committed to investing $14 billion across Africa. Mr. Obama is set to make the announcement today at the U.S.-Africa Business Forum in Washington. It's part of a three-day summit involving Mr. Obama and 50 African heads of state. A White House official says the investments include projects in the energy, banking, construction, and information technology fields. The U.S.-African Leaders Summit opened on Monday with forums touching on a range of issues, including regional health, security, the environment, and corruption. A second major airline has suspended flights to parts of West Africa because of the deadly Ebola outbreak in the region. British Airways said today that it's suspending flights to and from Liberia and Sierra Leone due to the deteriorating public health situation in both countries. It said the suspension is due to run until August 31st. The Dubai-based Emirates suspended the service to Guinea on August 2nd. The three countries are the epicenter of the Ebola outbreak that has killed nearly 900 people in the region this year. Amnesty International says it has found gruesome videos that it calls graphic evidence of multiple war crimes being carried out in Nigeria. Heather Murdoch reports.
Amnesty International accuses all sides of the conflict of human rights abuses, including Boko Haram, Nigerian security services, and government-allied civilian vigilante groups. Videos appear to show soldiers and vigilantes slitting the throats of detainees and dumping them into mass graves, the group says. Other videos show what appears to be the aftermath of a Boko Haram attack that destroyed a village and killed 100 people. Boko Haram says it wants to impose Islamic law on Nigeria, but regularly attacks Muslim clerics, mosques, and children. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
An earthquake of a magnitude 5.3 hit South Africa today, shaking buildings in Johannesburg and killing one person in a nearby town. The U.S. Geological Agency says the earthquake was centered 6 kilometers east of Orkney. It's a gold mining town about 170 kilometers southwest of Johannesburg. Emergency workers say a man in Orkney died when a wall collapsed on him. Mine shafts in the area were evacuated, but there were no injuries reported from underground. Taiwan is inspecting all underground gas lines for potential leaks after several underground explosions last week in the island's second largest city, killed 28 people and injured some 300 others. Ralph Jennings reports from Taipei.
While investigators continue to search for the exact cause of the series of explosions, authorities are taking steps to ensure that pipelines elsewhere in the country are safe. Taiwan's cabinet has ordered local governments to check the safety of underground gas pipelines by making sure the 21-year-old city and county computer records are up to date and complete. The cabinet will analyze that information and consult with 10 experts to decide what to do next. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
Rescue workers in Bangladesh fought high waves and strong currents today in their search for the wreckage of a ferry that capsized with more than 200 passengers on board. Officials said today that more than 100 people are still missing and feared dead from the accident to Monday on the Padma River in central Bangladesh. In the hours after the ferry capsized, local residents in fishing trawlers and speedboats tried to reach the site but had to turn back. Chinese rescue workers are continuing searching for survivors in the thousands of homes that collapsed after a powerful earthquake Sunday in the southwestern province of Yunnan. Authorities said today that the death toll has risen to 410, with 12 people still missing from the 6.1 magnitude quake. Russian news agencies say President Vladimir Putin has asked Russian lawmakers to revoke the right they had granted for Russian forces to intervene in Ukraine. Those reports said that President Putin issued that request in the upper house of parliament on Tuesday. And Japan used its annual defense paper today to issue a fresh warning about what it sees China's destabilizing actions.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The Ebola outbreak has killed nearly 900 people in Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and now Nigeria. This is the first time West Africa has seen Ebola, and it's turning out to be the worst outbreak of the disease ever, in part because people either don't know what to do or are refusing to comply with public health recommendations. Experts say education may be more effective than enforcement.
That's VOA West Africa correspondent Anne Look reporting details coming up.
Also in the news, an earthquake with a magnitude of 5.3 hit South Africa today, and the Suez Canal Authority announced today that Egypt will build a second canal to expand the 145-year-old waterway.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Niger, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the Ebola outbreak has killed nearly 900 people in Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and now Nigeria. This is the first time West Africa has seen Ebola, and it is turning out to be the worst outbreak of the disease ever, in part because people either don't know what to do or are refusing to comply with public health recommendations. Experts say education may be more effective than enforcement. VOA West Africa correspondent Anne Look has more.
Good afternoon, my people.
Good afternoon.
We have come in your community this afternoon to tell you about the danger of Ebola.
More of this is what public health experts say may turn the tide against Ebola. Health worker Bunch Wia met with a community in Margibi County, Liberia. Two people have died of the disease here.
Ebola has no cure. Ebola has no cure. But what you can do is to prevent yourself. What you can do is to prevent yourself from the deadly disease. Please stop eating bush meat. Please start touching your friend. Please start shaking hands. These are ways people can catch the Ebola disease.
People have plenty of questions.
So can I ask you? Yes, I want to know, they say Ebola don't have cure, but what happened when it...
This man says if there's no cure, then what can doctors do for people at the hospital? What's the point of going there? It's a common area of confusion. Health workers continue to remind people that some patients are fighting off the disease with medical care. They emphasize that for containment to work, sick people must be isolated so they don't infect others, and that every person who had contact with an Ebola patient's bodily fluids must be monitored in case any of those people get sick. That's how you stop the chain of infection. But that isn't happening everywhere in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, the countries hit hardest by the Ebola outbreak. The virus spread quickly across those countries' borders starting earlier this year. People did not know what the disease was. Some infected people hid from authorities or ran away. Families continued to handle and bury the bodies of Ebola victims, and so the disease continued to spread. Stephane Doyen, the West Africa chief for Doctors Without Borders, says that communities continue to resist medical assistance, and more education is needed. Doyen says in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and certain parts of Guinea, where we have trouble accessing certain villages, we know there are probably cases there, that people are dying and that the disease is spreading, but we can do nothing. He says we either don't know about the cases, or the population won't let us in, because they don't understand we are there to help. Liberia and Sierra Leone have deployed security forces to enforce containment measures and protect health workers amid growing hostility. It's illegal to knowingly harbor someone who has Ebola. Liberia is considering quarantining affected zones. Sierra Leone already has. But can the outbreak be stopped through such dramatic measures? Dr. Unnikrishnan, the head of Disaster Response and Prevention for Plan International.
These measures will have limitations. So this is where informing people, educating people, and encouraging them to come forward when they see symptoms is key. That's what will be finally be yielding results.
He says more international funds are needed for nearly every aspect of this response effort, especially education. Meanwhile, health workers continue going door to door. They're handing out leaflets and tying up signs with hand-drawn pictures of the various symptoms and putting catchy songs on the radio, scrambling to get to people before Ebola does. And look, VOA News, Dakar.
As drug companies search for a cure to Ebola, Nigerian health officials warn that false so-called remedies could help spread the disease, which has killed nearly 900 people this year in West Africa. Heather Murdoch has more from Abuja.
The Nigerian government says it is increasing health screenings at airports and international land borders after tests confirmed over the weekend that a Nigerian doctor has Ebola. The Lagos doctor cared for Patrick Sawyer, a Liberian-American finance consultant, who died of Ebola on July 25th, a few days after traveling from Liberia to Nigeria through Ghana and Togo. The doctor, whose name was not released, is currently being treated in isolation. Minister of Health Onibuchi Chukwu says the government is reassessing calls to close some Nigerian borders on a daily basis.
Regarding the issue of whether we should close our border, we still maintain that for now we are not doing that for a number of reasons, but if it becomes necessary, we'll do that.
Ebola has killed more than 800 people this year alone as it has spread to Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and now Nigeria. So far, the outbreak in Nigeria appears to be relatively contained, with one death and symptoms now showing in 8 currently isolated health workers who had direct contact with Sawyer. Humans catch Ebola either through handling or eating wild animals, or through contact with the blood or bodily fluids of an infected person. Bodies remain infectious after a person dies. Chukwu says officials are testing whether a body discovered in a morgue last week is carrying the Ebola virus. Authorities suspected the body was flown back to Nigeria after the person died of Ebola in a nearby country. The minister says Nigeria has moved to stop the import of bodies for burial from countries that have Ebola.
They should not bring back corpses from the 3 countries where we have the greatest number of cases. They should not bring back dead bodies. It's better that dead bodies are buried where they've had issues, except where it is clear from the death certificate that it is not Ebola.
Ebola is one of the world's deadliest diseases, with an up to 90% death rate. The death rate in the current West African outbreak is about 60%, a fact doctors attribute to early treatment. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Thank you, Heather. A second major airline has suspended flights to parts of West Africa because of the deadly Ebola outbreak in the region. British Airways said today that it is suspending flights to and from Liberia and Sierra Leone due to the deteriorating public health situation in both countries. It said the suspension is due to run until August 31st. The Dubai-based airline Emirates suspended its service to Guinea on August 2nd. The 3 countries are the epicenter of the Ebola outbreak that has killed nearly 900 people in the region this year. Late yesterday, the World Bank pledged up to $200 million to help Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone contain the outbreak, improve public health systems, and help communities cope with the economic impact of the crisis. The bank said workers have fled farming areas in Ebola-affected zones, although it said there has been no measurable impact on the food supply. Meanwhile, a second U.S. missionary who contracted Ebola in Liberia has arrived back in the United States. Nancy Reitbold traveled on a specially outfitted plane that landed in the southeastern city of Atlanta today. She will be treated at Emory University Hospital alongside an American doctor who also contracted the deadly virus while treating patients in Liberia. Both received a dose of an experimental serum before leaving Liberia.
An earthquake with a magnitude of 5.3 hit South Africa today, shaking buildings in Johannesburg and killing one person in a nearby town. The U.S. Geological Agency says the earthquake was centered 6 kilometers east of Orkney, a gold mining town about 170 kilometers southwest of Johannesburg. Emergency workers say a man in Orkney died when a wall collapsed on him. Mine shafts in the area were evacuated, but there was no injuries reported from underground. South Africa experiences periodic medium-sized earthquakes. The same area was hit by 4.9 magnitude tremor 2 months ago. The South African Press Association says today's earthquake lasted for about a minute and was felt in several cities, including Cape Town and Durban.
Past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The three-day U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit continues today here in Washington. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports on some of the latest developments.
The summit has addressed the issue of food security and climate change. Secretary of State John Kerry opened the session on that topic.
Every day, 8,000 children die because they don't have enough to eat. They don't have a healthy, nutritious diet. 8,000 children every single day. Around the world, 1 in 8 people suffers from chronic hunger. And in sub-Saharan Africa, that number, regrettably, is 1 in 4. So looking to the future, it's only going to become more difficult to bring these numbers down if you look at the realities of what is happening. For one thing, over the next several decades, the population of Earth is expected to grow, and it's expected to grow quickly. The 7 billion people that we're focused on feeding today is going to become more than 9 billion people by 2050, 35 years. And more than half of this population growth, I would add, is expected to occur in Africa. But on top of that, the growing impacts of climate change are going to put extraordinary stress on our ability to be able to produce the amount of food that we need to be able to feed those increasing numbers.
Kerry said the effects of climate change are already being felt and will only get worse unless action is taken on greenhouse gases. Those effects include longer and more frequent droughts, floods, wildfires, and unpredictable rainfall patterns.
There's a legitimate question that has to be asked, which is how do livestock thrive or even survive under those conditions? What happens if the great rivers of the Himalayas, that literally are the life source for so many billions of people on both sides, begin to be diverted and dry up because the glaciers are disappearing and the snow levels change? All you have to do is look at our ocean. The same carbon pollution that drives climate change is literally changing the ocean's chemistry. Between ocean acidification, overpollution, excessive pollution, and overfishing, the three great challenges of the ocean, our fish stocks are in serious trouble in almost every fishery of the world. And what will that mean for the 3 billion people who today exist on seafood as their major source of protein?
Kerry announced U.S. support for the Global Alliance for Climate Smart Agriculture.
This is a priority for U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who will hope to formally launch this initiative at the Climate Summit in New York this September. And today I'm happy to announce that the United States intends to formally sign on. I know that several other African countries here are prepared to make similar announcements, and we are working together to produce a declaration announcing our mutual intent to join this effort.
That's Secretary of State John Kerry. Today's schedule at the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit includes the U.S.-Africa Business Forum. It's hosted by the Department of Commerce and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg welcomed the participants.
Africa is today's biggest market opportunity in the global economy. And if you think I'm kidding, just look at the numbers. Africa is expected to reach a 5% overall growth rate in 2015. It boasts 6 of the world's 10 fastest growing economies. It registered more than 400,000 new companies in the last year alone. And its middle class, or consumer class, is the fastest growing in the world. The fact is, Africa is no longer emerging. It is here now.
However, Bloomberg said U.S. investment in Africa is not what it should be.
We have some catching up to do. Foreign investment in Africa has reached record highs, but that the United States is being driven more by its own domestic policies, and we are letting Europe and China go faster than the U.S. And while our exports to the continent are at a record high, it's also true that only 2% of our total exports go to Africa. And that means that we're missing out on a major opportunity to create jobs here at home.
Bloomberg added, there's no limit to the progress Africa can make in the coming decades.
Imagine for a moment an African labor force that will surpass India's and triple the size of Europe's. Imagine an Africa where extreme poverty, as we know it, is virtually eliminated, where a consumer class with rising incomes has greater purchasing power, where broadband access stretches from Cairo to Cape Town and all points in between, where climate change policies that protect Africa's coastal cities and farmlands go hand in hand with economic growth, and where people from around the world want to live and work to experience Africa's natural beauty, diverse cultures, and tolerant societies. That is the Africa that Africans want for their children and their children's children.
That's former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Secretary of Commerce Penny Pritzker also spoke to the U.S. African Business Forum. She said the time to do business in Africa is now.
Closer economic ties and rising demand create ample opportunities for businesses in the United States and Africa to build new partnerships, reach new markets, and support new jobs in the years to come. With each passing day, our commercial connections are deepening, our business bonds are increasing, and our trade partnership is maturing. Yet we have only just begun to scratch the surface.
U.S. Commerce Secretary Penny Pritzker. Also addressing the forum was African Union Chairperson Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma of South Africa.
This engagement between governments and business is an important stepping stone towards evaluating and strengthening the relationship between Africa and the United States, which is the purpose of our endeavors this week.
She says the summit is being held as many of Africa's economic indicators are doing well.
There's general consensus amongst the leadership and citizens of Africa that Africa is taking charge of its destiny to navigate a different course towards prosperity.
The AU chairperson says for Africa to succeed, there must be investment in its most precious resource.
Africa's most precious resource is its over a billion population, the majority of whom are young, and over half of them are women. Investing in their health, education, access to basic services and infrastructure is therefore critical to governments, regional organizations, and African Union alike.
African Union Chairperson Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Joe. And on this programming, known to President Obama is scheduled to address the U.S.-Africa Business Forum at 18:45 GMT. We will bring you his remarks live. And also, Africa's heads of state begin the second day of the U.S.-Africa Summit here in Washington. The main event today is a business forum bringing together hundreds of American and African CEOs. But the international aid agency ActionAid says one topic should not be ignored in this week's discussions, and that's agriculture. The agency says some of the poorest and hungriest people live in Africa, and most of them are smallholder farmers. In addition, the majority of Africa's livelihood is based on food production, and ActionAid says they are concerned about President Obama's vision for tackling hunger on the continent. Katie Campbell is a senior analyst for ActionAid. She spoke with me about the importance of including agriculture in this week's summit.
It's important that agriculture in Africa be addressed at this week's summit because the majority of Africans are getting their living from agriculture. There are 500 million smallholder farmers in the world, and many of them live in Africa. We're also seeing that many of the world's poorest and hungriest people also live in Africa, and there is a correlation between these two. Many smallholder farmers are among those who are poor and who are facing hunger. And so if we want to tackle large global issues like hunger, like poverty, we need to be thinking and talking about agriculture.
What would you like to see President Obama do now that he does have most of Africa's presidents here in Washington this week? How should he be addressing this issue with them?
Well, I think that President Obama should be honoring the commitments that African governments have already been making to address hunger and poverty in Africa. In June, we saw African governments come together at the African Union Summit in Equatorial Guinea and make a commitment to end hunger in Africa by 2025. They also committed to spending 10% of their own budgets on agriculture to address issues like hunger and poverty. And what we'd like to see is President Obama, as an influential donor and as an influential policymaker, to support those commitments that African governments are making to public investment in agriculture.
Another big concern that you all raised was that you have said President Obama has drastically shifted his food security policies, favoring such initiatives as the New Alliance. So why are these types of policies not good for Africa's smallholder farmers?
President Obama has started focusing more on initiatives that support large agribusiness in Africa. We don't think this is right for African agriculture because, as I said, the majority of farmers in Africa are smallholder farmers. They're on very small plots of land, and the investments that large agribusinesses are making in African agriculture are, at best, inappropriate for smallholder farmers. So they are promoting large technology that's not appropriate for these small farms. They're promoting seeds that, you know, don't work in the soil that smallholder farmers have. And at their worst, large agribusinesses are actually pushing smallholder farmers off their land. Many of us have heard about land grabs in recent years. This is a growing trend that is hurting smallholder farmers. So what these farmers need is investment from their own governments, support from their own governments, support from donor governments like the United States, and not investment from large agribusinesses that are basically going to leave them left out.
Another big factor in the U.S.-Africa summit is investing in Africa's youth. So how can Africa's leaders mobilize their young people to invest in a future in the agriculture industry?
Well, I think that we need to make agriculture a viable business for African youth. And in order to do that, we need to see governments investing in the agriculture sector more. So many African farmers, they don't have, especially women, don't have access to credit. They don't have access to inputs like seeds. They don't have access to the education that they need. They're not receiving extension services from their government to educate them on how to farm better and more efficiently. And many of those things are things that we have in countries like the United States that our government provides our farmers here. African farmers are not provided with that investment from their governments. And I think that if more were invested in African farmers, that youth would see more opportunities. They would see that they could make a living from farming and that this is a viable way to support their families.
That was Katie Campbell, Senior Policy Analyst for ActionAid. She spoke with me from Washington, D.C.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
On What's Happening Africa. This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there's a youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The Ebola outbreak has killed nearly 900 people in Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and now Nigeria. An earthquake with a magnitude of 5.3 hit South Africa today. And the Suez Canal Authority announced today that Egypt will build a second canal to expand the 145-year-old waterway. Coming up, music from Niger. And in our feature segment, the importance of security issues at the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday, Kim.
Thank you. Happy Tuesday to you, too. And I understand you're a record soccer crowd tops your sports report this evening.
Kim, joining us once again on the Voice of America from Johannesburg to talk about that record soccer crowd is our African football guru, David Legg. Hello, David.
Tommy.
David, let's kick off in the U.S. city of Ann Arbor, Michigan. That's where a record crowd of 109,318 poured into Michigan Stadium over the weekend to watch Manchester United beat Real Madrid 3-1 in a friendly match between two of Europe's top clubs. It's the largest crowd ever to watch a soccer match here in the USA, David. What's your reaction to the record attendance, and how does it compare with some of the big games you've seen in Africa?
Yeah, Sonny, the minute I heard that fixture was coming, Real Madrid versus Manchester United, I said to myself, wherever they stage that match in the United States, it's going to be a sellout. And the figure is astounding, Sonny. It actually beats anything in Africa. The best we can do here in Africa is 93,000 at the Soccer City Stadium, just a few kilometers from where I'm speaking to you. That's in Soweto. That was the venue for the 2010 World Cup final in which Spain beat the Netherlands. But that's the biggest stadium, Sonny, in Africa. We've got some other pretty big ones. In Algiers, for example, 80,000. In Kinshasa, the Martyrs Stadium, 80,000. In Egypt, Sonny, the Cairo Stadium officially holds 73,000. But I believe larger crowds than that have squeezed their way in. And as we know only too well on the sunny side of sport, this sometimes is a major problem in Africa. Too many fans, too many extra fans getting into grounds. And then, of course, if something goes wrong, chaos, panic, and inevitably stampedes and deaths. Another big one, Sonny, the Tunisian National Stadium, they hold 60,000. But the Michigan crowd, isn't it amazing? It's Real Madrid and Manchester United. Manchester United coming off, by their standards, an awful season in which, of course, ended with their coach, David Moyes, being sacked and replaced by the Dutch coach, Louis van Gaal. But that power, that magnetism that draws people to watch them clearly is very much there in the United States. And I've watched, Sonny, I've stayed up late in South African time to watch these exhibition matches in various cities in the United States. And generally, they seem to be very well attended. Obviously, the performances of the USA at the World Cup in Brazil have rubbed off, and the interest is there. And that is great, Sonny, because I think for a healthy world game in football, you need the United States to be involved.
David, as we talk, most of Africa's heads of state are here in Washington for an African Leaders Summit hosted by U.S. President Barack Obama.
Hello, everybody.
I would imagine one of the topics of discussion is the deadly Ebola outbreak in West Africa. David, what impact does Ebola have on African football?
Well, so far, Sonny, not too much, thankfully, but I think things are about to get very serious. Let's just briefly go backwards. Seychelles last week, they decided not to admit the Sierra Leone team to their island in the Indian Ocean, and therefore they had to forfeit the Thai. And it was really sad for people from the Seychelles because their national team had gone all the way across Africa to Sierra Leone. They put up a brave fight. They lost the match 2-0. And one of the football officials said that there was tremendous interest in the return match. They were clearly hopeful of overturning that two-goal disadvantage. Personally, Sonny, I think Sierra Leone would have qualified anyway, but this brought home what Ebola. At the moment, there's no cure for it, and that is the really frightening thing. Now, Sonny, there are four countries in Africa where deaths have been reported of late. They are Nigeria, Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia. Now, Liberia are out of the 2015 Cup of Nations qualifiers. They were beaten by Lesotho. But Nigeria, Sierra Leone, and Guinea are very much involved. Nigeria are the defending champions. They had a bye into the group stage. So had Guinea. And Sierra Leone qualified by beating Swaziland and then getting that walkover over the Seychelles. Now, come sunny September 5 and 6, Nigeria are due to host Rwanda. Sierra Leone travel to Ivory Coast and Guinea host Togo. And then, just a few days later, on September the 10th, Nigeria are due to play in South Africa. Sierra Leone will be at home to the Democratic Republic of Congo. And Guinea travel to Uganda. And the questions are, first of all, will these countries that are affected, will they be allowed to host matches? And secondly, looking at the Seychelles issue, will they be able to travel into other countries? For example, will my country, South Africa, admit the Nigerians, fearful perhaps that some of those players might be affected by Ebola? It's scary, Sonny. And if the disease spreads to other countries, we could have chaos. Never since 1968, when the first qualifiers for the Cup of Nations were staged, have we had a situation like this one. Potentially, we're looking at major problems. In the sense, can Sierra Leone, Nigeria, and Guinea host matches? Is it safe for them to host matches? And secondly, will other countries in the groups permit Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Nigeria to travel to their countries? No word yet, Sonny, from CAF, but I'm sure we're going to hear from them very soon. They must be planning now because it's just about 4 weeks to go before these first matches at the group level.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. In more African football news, Kenya has named Bobby Williamson the new head coach of the national team, the Harambee Stars. Williamson is from Glasgow, Scotland, the venue for the recent Commonwealth Games. And you might say the Kenya job is an early birthday present for the Scotsman, who'll celebrate his 53rd birthday next week. Now, Williamson has been coaching in East Africa since 2008, when he was appointed head coach of Uganda's national team, the Cranes. He was sacked by the Ugandans in April 2013. And for the past year, he's been in charge of the Kenyan club Gor Mahia, which is based in Nairobi. Bobby Williamson takes over from Adel Amrouche, an Algerian who was fired by the Kenya Football Federation 2 days ago, following Kenya's 1-0 aggregate loss to Lesotho in a 2015 Africa Cup of Nations qualifying series. Meanwhile, the Kenyans have also named the country's most capped player, Musa Otero Otieno, as an assistant to Williamson, and another former international player for Kenya, Simon Mulama, has been named team manager. Turning to tennis, Africa's highest-ranked men's player, Kevin Anderson of South Africa, survived a first-round scare at the Rogers Cup in Toronto, Canada, where he eventually beat young Australian qualifier Tanasi Kokkinakis in three sets. The match in Toronto was interrupted four times by heavy rain showers. In a post-match interview with reporter Kirsten Lonsdale, Anderson admitted he was rattled by his opponent, who just broke into the world's top 200.
It was a really tough match. Quite a lot of factors to deal with. Most of all was my opponent. He was playing really good tennis. He's a youngster, and sometimes it's a little tough coming out and playing something like that. Who's swinging out quite freely, and he's got a very lively arm, good serve, good forehand, and there's some of the building blocks, to being a very tough tennis player. And I think definitely you'll see more of him to come. And added to that, obviously the rain delays, stopped me starting. It was like four times today, and I'm really happy with the way I came out, my energy levels at the end, and feeling healthy as well, and that's always a tough aspect. So overall, I'm very happy with today's match.
What do you think was the difference? Was it just experience in the end?
Yeah, I think, coming off to the first set was, I was a little rattled and a little, I was beating myself up a little bit, but, came back in the second, and, it was funny, even in the first set, I thought I was serving well. He was just taking some big cracks on my serve. I don't think I've, lost that many first serve points when I've, actually serving a pretty high percentage, and managed to get that break and gain confidence. And I think it was a lesson for myself to learn as well. I think it was a good example of how I want to compete.
That's South African tennis player Kevin Anderson. And Kevin was talking with reporter Kirsten Lonsdale in Toronto, Canada, the venue for this week's Rogers Cup hardcourt tournament. Kevin is ranked number 21 in the world in the latest men's tennis rankings. That's the highest position of any African player. Meanwhile, the ATP Tour, the governing body for men's professional tennis, says the inaugural Israel Open in Tel Aviv has been canceled because of security concerns arising from the military conflict in the region. The tournament was scheduled to be held from September 15th to September 21st. It would have been the first ATP event held in Israel since 1996. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. Here in Washington, U.S. President Barack Obama is hosting an African Leaders Summit this week. Do you think sports has been a neglected topic during these summits by African leaders as a way to develop the continent? Tweet me your comments or post them at my Facebook page, and I might read your remarks during the show later this week. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit, focusing on security, business, and investment. And next, women in South Sudan demanding a voice in the peace process. But first, some music. Here is Kaidan Gaskia of Niger with Africa.
Oh, Lord! Africa, hey! Yes, man, for a peace and love night in Africa. For lights, God bless Africa. Africa, Africa. What's the know?
Africa dance, my people crying. Play. Every day,
play.
Yo, yo, yo. Man, for a peace and love night in Africa. Hey. Hey, hey, hey.
Les bombes à gaz nationales, les bombes chimiques nationales, les bombes atomiques nationales, les bombes nucléaires nationales, les chars de guerre nationales, les armes de guerre nationales, l'avion de guerre nationale, l'avion de guerre nationale.
Mon rêve, c'est de voir l'Afrique s'unir. Plus de guerre, plus de mort, plus de génocide. Mon rêve, c'est de voir une Afrique libre, libre d'opinion, d'expression, tu le sais. Africa dance, my people crying. Every day,
play.
Oh, yo, 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 it's supposed to be the love night to ever write. Hey, 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 Africa done,
play.
My people run, every day,
play.
Oh, yo, 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 it's supposed to be the love night to ever write. Hey,
Hey, hey, hey. Mwaska tuniga diga di, mwaska tuniga makama, mwaska tuniga maise samse lokjo gunega kweipa, mwaska tuniga maise samse lokjo sinega kweipa, mwaska tuniga kaka kama, mwaska tuniga baika bai, mwaska tuniga baifa samse bani siga tepa. Alwatu kuni gunega di hankasi kano bise, alwatu kuni gunega di apikla baino gunega se, alwatu kuni gunega di borbila baino gunega se, alwatu kuni gunega di borbisa keno gunega se, alwatu kuni gunega di wongeha waibo heiga bu, alwatu kuni gunega di wongeha sakai koga bu, alwatu kuni gunega di iko gaze hakiga ba. Botuniga ke mate apo apikla bai mate apo borbila bai mate apo borbisa ke mate apo e gali shkur mate apo pyru se pyru and what you think mate apo pyru gum pyru gum
Africa done my people one every day boy yo 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 it's for the people love night ever right hey 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 Africa done my people one every day boy yo 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 it's for the people love night ever right hey hey hey
Man, tu sais, mon chat n'a son inité. On fait que diviser, nos dirigeants sont dirigés. Yeah, man, plus les Babylones déguisés. Ils ont mis l'Afrique en flamme, ils ne font que la diser. Ce sont nos babysés. Comme des chouins, Afrique, ça reste en soudé. Nous avons les mains dans la main, on veut toujours s'imposer. Nous perdons le système, divisé pour le régner. Yeah, Babylone, à la base de tous les coups d'état. Yeah, Babylone, à la base de tous les attentats. Yeah, Babylone, garde toutes tes tonnes d'armes et de bombes, de mines et de tuiles. Hey, hey, hey. Well, l'Afrique a besoin de l'unité. Well, l'Afrique a besoin de paix. Well, l'Afrique ne doit plus être endettée. Well, l'Afrique ne doit plus être enflammée. Well, c'est le berceau de l'humanité.
Africa.
C'est le berceau de l'humanité.
Africa.
We wanna be free, yeah.
Africa.
We wanna be free, yeah.
Kaidan Gaskia of Niger with Africa.
Well, the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit has opened and scores of heads of state are attending. The focus of the summit is on security, business, and investment. Joe Siegel is the Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies at National Defense University in Washington. Reporter William Eagle asked him about the challenge ahead for the delegates as they discuss security issues.
Part of the challenge for any security coverage of Africa is the diversity of security issues on the continent and the complexity of these challenges, because they, in the most part, have a domestic component to them as well as a transnational component to them. And I think the challenge for the heads of state and President Obama when they meet will be in sort of unpacking those issues, that in almost every case there is a strong governance component, or, you know, a weak governance component to the threat, which has fueled grievances and has allowed insurgencies to take hold. And then these have at times linked up with the various transnational networks and influences.
Are there likely to be any new ideas or new partnerships, or would it just be a case of strengthening partnerships that are already there?
You know, for the most part, I anticipate that what we'll see is the strengthening of partnerships that are already in place. The U.S. has been a long-time supporter of peace operations in Africa, and one of the major supporters financially of that, as well as providing logistic support and training capacity. I think that that will continue to be the case, and that will come out of the summit as one area of increased attention and focus. I think the focus on an early warning system, conflict prevention, you know, will get some attention and some perhaps additional resources to support. Again, this has been part of the Africa peace and security architecture already, but at times is not as operational as I think it is hoped. And I think a third area of attention will be on security sector reform initiatives, in this the sense that there's a recognition that part of the challenge is that Africa's police and military aren't always very professional, and this can lead to inappropriate or heavy-handed responses, especially when we're dealing with domestic types of security threats, which involve a lot of innocent bystanders, and this tends to alienate the local population and further fuel grievances that might be felt. And I think trying to work at how to professionalize and increase accountability structures for Africa's security sectors will be another focal point of the discussion.
Speaking of security and also human rights, does the Leahy Amendment come into the equation? Is that likely to come up? The Leahy Law prohibits funds from being used to train security forces of a foreign country that violate human rights.
Well, I think Leahy will be part of the discussion, as it has been. What we hear are mixed perceptions of the effectiveness of the Leahy Law. On the one hand are those who feel like it's been a successful initiative. It has, you know, set a good standard for vetting African security sectors before the U.S. provides them any resources or training or even opportunities to participate in seminars and things like that. On the other hand, there, you know, is some move to try to loosen the standards so that the U.S. has more flexibility when it needs to move quickly to try to support African militaries who are dealing with crisis situations. And so, you know, there's the perception by some that they saw handcuffs that limit how flexible they can be in times of crisis. So I think, you know, the issue will be in the background of the conversations that come up with regard to the security sector and peace and security issues in Africa and, you know, how U.S. security partnership moves forward on the continent.
It's said that there's not going to be any bilateral or one-on-one meetings between President Obama and the African presidents. Is that a problem? Does that diminish the importance of the summit?
Well, I think that reflects the different approaches that the U.S. and various African leaders have going into the meetings. From the U.S. perspective is very much relationship building and creating a stronger platform to do more collaboration down the line. You know, the U.S., I think, is not looking at it as a one-on-one undertaking, that this is really looking at U.S. policy towards Africa writ large. I think for some of the African leaders, the attraction of coming is to have some face-to-face time with President Obama. And so there's likely to be some disappointment about that. You know, I think the Obama team just decided it wasn't a good use of time to just have these, you know, back-to-back 5 to 10 minute meetings that wouldn't, you know, really be very substantive and would probably be exhausting for the president.
That was Joe Siegel of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies at National Defense University in Washington. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle.
South Sudanese women's rights activists say the country's leaders have failed to bring the seven-month-old civil war to an end. As a result, deepened ethnic divisions. As Philip Eliu reports from Juba, the women are demanding a voice in the peace process from this point forward.
About 200 women from an umbrella group of women's organizations told members of the National Platform for Peace and Reconciliation in Juba that thousands of South Sudanese women and children lost their lives and thousands of others continue to suffer in IDP camps, but the delegates to the talk in Addis Ababa do not seem to care. They say it is only when women are included in the talks that unique gender concerns and concrete steps toward peace building will actually come to fruition in South Sudan. Jane Gordon, chairperson of the Women Network for Peace and Reconciliation, says the conflict has created hatred among South Sudanese ethnic communities. Gordon says women can restore peace and harmony to the nation. She says representatives of the women group hope to convey that message to President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar in person.
They said enough is enough. They don't want any fight. They wanted to meet President, and they wanted also to meet Riek, if possible. If they failed, they wanted to meet their wives because they are the ones suffering, and they wanted to talk to these ladies, to talk to their husbands, that we don't want war anymore. Okay, there is a mistake between children as a mother. Children can fight. You come back and reconcile and let us go ahead with our development because we don't want to hear any guns at night. We don't want to even to run anywhere.
Gordon says women whose husbands and children are paying the ultimate price on the battlefields also when their voices hurt.
There is a gap between the women at the higher level and the grassroots women. We are going to plan for meeting between these women who used to go to Addis Ababa together and want to discuss with them face to face and see a way forward.
Gordon says the grassroots Women Network for Peace and Reconciliation will be visiting internally displaced persons in camp to convey their message to other women, especially mothers nursing babies in difficult conditions. Women rights activist Guliba Florian Akim says she believes lasting peace will only be achieved at home if South Sudanese own the talks.
Peace will never be achieved in Addis. We can achieve peace in South Sudan, back in our where localities where we are coming from. We believe as women, we are not fighting. It's the men fighting. Because these are our husbands, these are our sons, these are our relatives who are fighting. But as women, when we come together, we'll be able to unify these men.
The women say they will work with the National Platform for Peace and Reconciliation, and they will contact the members of parliament. But they will also continue to demand more representation at the negotiating table in Addis Ababa to try to achieve lasting peace in the country. For BOA News, I am Philip Aleu in Juba.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The leaders of some 50 African nations are gathering here in Washington to meet with U.S. government, business, and civil society leaders to discuss trade and investment, peace and regional stability, and governing for the next generation. The three-day summit, August 4th, 5th, and 6th, will do more than that, however. It will also underscore our nation's commitment to Africa's people, democracy, and governance, and highlight our commitment to addressing issues that affect us all. Increased engagement with the nations of Africa is a high priority of U.S. foreign policy. President Barack Obama has emphasized how important this relationship is, beginning with his traveling to Ghana soon after taking office in 2009. Last year, presidential trips to South Africa, Tanzania, and Senegal saw the announcement of the Power Africa program, a U.S. initiative to help double access to electrical power in sub-Saharan Africa and spur greater economic development there. The 2014 U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit, the first time that the vast majority of the continent's leaders have gathered here, is another step in our efforts to demonstrate U.S. commitment to the continent. Discussions will center on how to make progress in key areas that Africans themselves see as critical to the future of the continent, expanding trade and investment ties, promoting inclusive sustainable development, expanding cooperation on peace and security, and ensuring a better future for Africa's next generation. They will also focus on civil society, women, health, wildlife trafficking, and food security in a changing climate, as well as achieving a successful post-2015 development agenda during the official U.S. government-sponsored signature events. A related U.S.-Africa business forum is expected to result in hundreds of millions of dollars worth of agreements between U.S. and African firms. In addition, these events follow a week of meetings between 500 young African leaders and U.S. government, civil society, and business leaders in which social policy, good governance, business, and technology were discussed as part of President Obama's Young African Leaders Initiative. Forging stronger personal connections among leaders advances America's and Africa's many, many shared priorities. It also fosters further future engagement and deepens the partnership between the American and African peoples as we both pursue a better future for us all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237 USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.